All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this special podcast episode. My name is Tarek. This is my business partner, David. And we have a special guest today called Michael Francis. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me give you guys an introduction who Michael actually is. For those of you who don't know, in the German market, actually a lot of people that were here knew you, right?
Many people did, yes.
Most of the hands went up.
Social media, documentaries.
Yeah.
Also some German rapper use your name in the lyrics.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, I'll try to give an introduction. You, Michael, were part of the Colombo organized crime family back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Your father, Sonny Francis, who is a big idol of yours when you were growing up and was also a main member of the Colombo mm-hmm. mafia family.
Yes.
You don't like the term mafia, so we use La Cosa Nostra, right? Mm-hmm. And well, since this is a business-related podcast, the figure that comes to mind first is that you were one of the highest-earning mafia bosses of all time. Is that correct?
That's what they say, yes.
All right. Well, very, very great way to put it. So could you maybe start off and tell us about your upbringing? You know, me and you, we talked already a lot about it, but I found that very interesting is the way your father raised you and what kind of environment it was that you were raised in, which is, you know, one in a million.
Well, it was pretty turbulent because my dad was such a high profile figure. He was a major target of law enforcement, probably the most high profile of his era. And so he was constantly under investigation, constantly, you know, being arrested, constantly going to trial. So we grew up through, you know, that all that turbulence, myself, brothers and sisters, my mother, obviously. And I love my dad. He was my idol. He was a great father, good husband to my mother, but always into problems. So, you know, as a result, because I idolized my dad, I hated law enforcement. I hated the government. You know, I grew up in that kind of crazy way of thinking. And so I had that attitude, you know, from an early age because I felt the government was harassing my father, harassing my family. But my dad was smart. He tried to keep me out of the life. He wanted me to go to school, get an education. Thought that was very important. He wanted me to be a doctor, actually. And I was on that road. I was a pre-med student when my dad, who had gone through many trials during my childhood, was indicted in a big federal case, a bank robbery case. Was convicted and sentenced to 50 years in prison, which to me was a death sentence. My dad was 50 when he went in. So, you know, I lost interest in school. Joe Colombo was the boss of my family. He kind of took me under his wing, obviously knew the family well. And over a period of, you know, a time, I just said, if I don't help my father out of prison, he's going to die in there. And it was a conversation that we had in the penitentiary in Leavenworth in a visiting room where I said, Dad, I'm not going to school, because my dad said he was innocent. He was framed on the case. I believe that until this day. And I said, if I don't help you out, you're going to die in here. And basically, it was during that conversation when he said, if you're going to be on the street, I want you on the street the right way. And he proposed me for membership into that life, because you can't just go up to somebody and say, hey, I'd like to join. You know, somebody has to sponsor you, propose you.
And you have to be Italian, is that correct?
Your father has to be Italian.
Oh, okay.
To be officially indoctrinated into that life, your father must be Italian.
Interesting. Is it the same way nowadays as well?
Yeah, well, what I heard is that they were, because there were so many informants that happened in the 80s, that they said your mom and dad had to be Italian. I don't know what.
So it's for informants' reasons. So they try to keep it in the family just because of not getting any information outside.
That's what I've heard. I don't know if that's true or not, but definitely your father. You can't be non-Italian and be in that life.
Interesting.
Your mother could have been of another descent, but you're not your dad.
You've talked about the turbulences. How old were you in this stage where you got confronted with father always in prison? And
you know, you remember certain things in your life, and for whatever reason, they have that much of an impression. I can't explain it, but I was probably 4 years old. And my dad had moved us from Brooklyn to Long Island, where my grandparents lived, my mother's parents. And I didn't see my dad for a couple of days. Didn't know what he wanted, 4 years old. And then one morning, he comes to my grandmother's house, and heavy beard, he hadn't shaved, which was unlike him, and he had a heavy beard. And he came in and he embraced my mother in the living room. I came down, I was sitting on the steps. He embraced my mother and they were talking. And then he came over to me and hugged me. And one of his guys was out on the porch and I can see through the window and he was like standing guard. And then he left. He was maybe there a half an hour. And what it was, the family was at war during that time. It was a war for leadership. So obviously I didn't understand what was going on then, but that was my earliest impression of what's going on here. Why is my dad missing? And for some reason, there were other incidents, but that one just stands out. And it was like embossed in my brain. So I was 4 years old. It never stopped from that point on. My dad just got in trouble and in jail, out of jail. And just, it was a turbulent time with him.
But how did you handle that emotionally?
You know, people have asked me that. I don't know. I think it's all, it's what you are inside, because quite honestly, and I don't demean them at all for that, my brothers and sisters couldn't handle it. And it really played on their life to their detriment. And it didn't end up good for any one of them. I don't know. I can't explain it. It was just, I was able to deal with it and function. And I can't explain it. I don't know why.
No, it's something very interesting is David and me, we popularized in Germany the saying, the show has to go on. In German, we say, es muss weitergehen. So we use this term for everything. If anything good happens or bad happens. So if we break another revenue record, we like, the show must go on. If we have a horrible week, we say the show must go on, you know, no matter what the ups and downs are. And we'll get into the business side of your life as well. You said to me in the van, I asked Michael, I was like, I mean, so much money. Like, did that get to your head? And he's like, it was just business to me. It's just another revenue and that's just another turnover. And I think that's a good way of not, you know, over emotionalizing certain events in your life and just being like, that's part of the journey now. Let's move on.
It's how I dealt with things. I never got too high on the money or too low on the money. I can tell you this. I hated not having money in my pocket. I just could not. I couldn't exist. I wouldn't go out if I didn't have money. Because what happened to me at 19, 20 years old, I got in a lot of trouble. I was indicted several times and I was on trial for over a year in four different cases. So I was 20 or 21. And I was broke because I was paying lawyers. I didn't have any money really. My mother couldn't support me. My father's in jail. And when I, after all the cases were finished and I beat them, because that's very time consuming, obviously you're in court all day, fighting your case at night, cases were over, I'm broke. And I couldn't deal with it. That I couldn't deal with, being broke. So I immediately started to hustle, you know, and started to put money in my pocket and in every innovative way that I could find to do it, legitimately, you know. But I was so motivated to make money just not to be broke. I didn't want to make money so I can buy a brand new car. I didn't want to make money. I just didn't want to be without money in my pocket, you know? So that was a great motivator for me.
So the first money you made, you didn't make with the gas business, right? The first money you made with cars, was it that?
You know, it was a couple of things. When I got out of, it was funny. When I finished my trials, I had a friend who came to me who had a flea market. You know, 2 days a week, flea market. And so I'm 21, 22 years old. He says, Michael, come to work for me on the weekends. I'll pay X amount of dollars. It wasn't a lot, a couple hundred bucks. And this is when I started to realize that maybe I had something going within me, just natural. So guys were coming to me in a flea market. It was a big market. It was indoor and outdoor. And they would come to me and they said, you know, Michael, I need a really good spot today. You know, I'll give you an extra few bucks if you give me this spot here. I was managing the market. I said, can't do that. I'm cheating my partner. I mean, the guy that, you know, gave me this. And then guys would come over and I say, you know, I'm really broke and I wish I could buy some more merchandise and this and that. So I went to this guy, his name was Vinny Vingo. And I said, Vinny, listen, I don't want to do this behind your back, but people are coming to me. They want a better spot. They're ready to hand me a lot of money. What if I take it and I split it with you? Do it. I like that. Okay. I said, and then they're coming to me. They need to buy merchandise. I said, it's perfect. We lock their stuff up at night. They can't run away. They got to come back on Saturday. If not, we have their merchandise. So I said, give me some money. I'll lend it out to them, whatever you want to charge. So we started a loan business. It was actually shylocking because it wasn't legitimate. We were charging them interest, weren't hurting them, maybe 1% a week, whatever was good for them. And that built into a big business for me. I was making several thousand dollars a week between both of those.
How old were you?
At 21, 22.
21.
So that's when I started to realize there were different ways to make money. I also had an auto body shop that my father owned. When he went to jail, the guy owned it. It wasn't a very good operator. But at that time, they had these Ford Pintos. It was way before your time. It was a little Ford car. The Pinto and then Chevrolet had a matching car to that. But the Pintos were great. They would be totaled out quickly. You hit them in the front, boom, they're totaled, right? So as long as there was no engine damage, I would buy these little Pintos. I knew I had worked for my dad in that shop. I would fix them up on the weekend and sell them and make myself $2,000, $2,500. So I was working for the guy. And then I said, listen, I don't want to work for you anymore. I want to rent a spot here. Let me just rent this spot. And I want to work on my own. If I use any paint or supplies, I'll pay you. So that's what I started doing. So between the weekends there and then during the week, I started making $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for myself a week at that age. And that's when I enjoyed the taste of money. And I was able to help my mom out because, you know, the big fallacy is that a guy like my dad goes to prison and everybody's taking care of the family. Well, that's not true at all. My dad had some things going on the street where he had income, but after 2 or 3 years, that ran out and nobody gave us anything. So I had to help my mom and help support the kids. So that was my motivator.
And back then, $3,000 on a week was like 10 nowadays.
It was a lot of money. It was three, sometimes $5,000 a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were doing extremely well and it happened fairly quick.
And then the move that you did, because I watched a lot of your stuff, obviously, is someone came to you and said, look, I have this scheme. Maybe you can get into it with a gas business. What happened there? That was like a big hit, right?
Yeah, well, you know, now I'm part of the life already. I was indoctrinated to the life and I'm doing fairly well. I had a couple of automobile dealerships and that's another story how I acquired them. But a lot of people think in that life that mob guys sit in their social clubs and say, oh, we're going to attack that business. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. No. So often, a guy within a company will come to us with a scheme to defraud their company. I've had General Electric people come to me. Mazda Motors of America come to me. City National Bank come to me with scams on how they can do it. Insurance companies. It happened all the time. When you're on the street and people start to recognize that you're a business guy and a guy they can talk to, you attract a lot of people. And I did that. And so there was a guy that had a small gasoline operation out in the street in Long Island. And he came to me for help because there were two guys from another family, a Genovese family, I believe, were shaking him down, extorting him for money. So he came to me for help. And I looked into him a little bit and I didn't want to help him. I said, no, I don't want to get involved in this. Because I heard something about him that I didn't like at the time. But he was very persistent. He kept coming back, kept coming back. And finally, I sat him down because he said, listen, I have a scheme, Michael. He said, I need you. I think you can help me with it. I know you can. And I said, what's your scheme? He said, we can defraud the government out of tax on every gallon of gasoline. Now, I hated the government, right? And I can be honest with you right now to all your listeners, and please don't think it the wrong way. I have no moral issue whatsoever with taking tax money from the government. Because our country is $34 trillion in debt. And the way they fix that is by going into more debt every year and trying to raise the money by raising it on taxpayers. That's immoral. It's not illegal because they make the laws, but that's immoral. So I have no problem in retaining tax money from the government, but I won't do it now. I want to get that straight to all your listeners. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to get myself in trouble or put my family, you know, in a problem. So I won't do it, but I don't have a moral issue with it because I think I'll do better with the money than they will. But anyway, so I said, okay. He describes the scheme a little bit for me and he says, this is the idea that I have. I said, well, you know, the implementation of this is not going to be easy. I said, we need accountants. We need certain ways to do this. So the wheels started turning. We go into business together, form a new company. I didn't want to get involved in his company in case he owed taxes or whatever. I was clean at that point. And I have a fellow around me. One of my associates was a butcher, but he was a smart business guy. And I said, Vinny, I want you to stay with Larry and let's see what he's doing. Let me see. So Vinny comes to my house maybe 2 weeks later. And he was a big guy, a big imposing guy, a big scar across his head. He was an imposing guy. He comes to my house on a Saturday morning and he used to bring us meat. And he's got a box on his shoulder. And this was my first wife. I was married for a short time. So I says to him, what are we doing with all that meat? Are we having a party or something? I don't know anything about it. He says, it ain't meat, Chief. Come in the kitchen. He called me Chief. So I go in the kitchen with him. He puts the box on the table. He opens it up. I immediately start to smell gasoline. And I said, what is that? He said, it's the first week and a half's take in the gas business. It was $320,000. He certainly got my attention. So over the next 7+ years, we built that 320 into $8 to $10 million a week, basically defrauding the government out of tax on every gallon of gasoline. Simplistic in nature, we had to do a lot to implement it to not get in trouble with the government, because the way it worked, originally, the tax was collected at the gas station level. So we either acquired or owned, leased, operated over 300 stations. The government started to realize that they would go to a station that owned tax. You'd run it for 7, 8, 9, 10 months. When you knew the time was up, it would take them that long to get to you. You close that station down. The owner is gone, finished, and then you lease it to somebody else. You go back into business. You find a new friend. Well, the government started to figure that out. So they started to advertise, we're not going to collect it at the gas station level anymore. You're going to have to be a licensed wholesaler in order to do it. Well, by the time they finished advertising and implementing, we already had the way to get around it. Put my team to work. We already understood what to do. We made more money when they changed the law than when we did before. And it was an easier operation. So the government didn't know what he was doing. So I had 18 companies. They were all Panamanian companies. Why Panama? Panama at the time, the company, they were bearer stock. If you held the stock, you owned the company. If I wanted to make you the owner, I just gave you the stock. You were the owner. So we had bearer stock. We didn't have to put any name. I only needed the company in order to open a bank account and to get the license. So I had 18 Panamanian companies. I had a contact, political contact that was getting me the licenses. And we had 18 companies, and it was basically a daisy chain. We were able to keep the government off our back for 10 to 12 months until we knew they were coming down on us, raid the office, whatever. And then we would just shut down that license, move across the street or another place and start again on a new license. And they had no clue what we were doing.
You were very clever with it, right? Like you made sure that other gas stations around you knew that you had an unfair advantage.
Yes. What I would do is, let's say there were four gas stations on a major intersection. We would buy or obtain one of them. I would gather the other three around and say, listen, here's the deal. We're always going to be cheaper than you. We're going to be a penny under, 2 cents under, whatever. If you go down 5 cents, I'll go down 8. If you go down 10, I'll go down 20. I'll put you out of business. So just understand that we're going to make, well, how are you doing that? None of your business. Don't ask questions. This is how it's going to be. Well, before you know it, they were all buying gas from us. We maintained the same relationship where we were always cheaper, but they were also buying gas from us. So everybody wanted it from us. And the thing was, yes, we were taking taxpayer money, but we were lowering the prices at the pump. So people were paying less at our gas stations. So we were taking the tax money and giving them back some at the pump. So we became like the Robin Hoods. And the government couldn't figure out how we were manipulating things or what the mechanics of the operation was. I'll tell you how serious it got. I had two FBI agents. I had a Mazda dealership and they came to my showroom one day, had my offices there. We need to talk to you. So I go outside and it's, what do you guys want? We know what you're doing. We know you're doing something, but we don't know how you're doing it. What are you talking about? Gas. What are you talking about? Michael, just tell us how you're doing it and we'll give you a pass. I said, you're going to give me a pass. Yeah. I was born in the morning, not yesterday morning. I'm never getting a pass. I'm saying to myself, I said, guys, I don't know what you're talking about. You want to buy a car? I'll sell you a car. I'll give you a good deal or whatever. Well, I got to tell you, they got so angry with me. They were cursing me out when they left. But that was their frustration because they could not figure it out. Couldn't do it. We were always a step ahead of them. I'll tell you how serious you got. I bought a terminal from British Petroleum. We needed one terminal at least to as part of the scheme. And I think we stored 3.5 million gallons, a lot less than what we needed, but it was good for us. And they actually went to all the major oil companies, Shell Oil, Mobil Oil. We were buying from all of them. We were buying barges as they came across from the Middle East and selling them back to their stations. They didn't care because we were buying it from them anyway. They didn't care how it went, right? So the FBI would go to them and say, these guys are all, they're mafia guys and they're taking you. Oh yeah, okay, well let us know. And they would come to us and tell us the FBI was here. They didn't care. They did not care.
So at the peak, you're making what 10 million a week?
We were selling 500 million gallons approximately a month. One week, maybe 8 million, next week, 12 million. It averaged $8 to $10 million a week.
Was that the revenue or profit?
That was revenue that came in.
Okay.
Yeah, we had an operation, but there wasn't a lot of expenses. We had guys on the, truck drivers that things like that. I mean, this was really a brain deal.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we had accountants that we trusted to manipulate the books the way we needed it, because we reported. Mm. We reported, but we didn't have a lot of expenses.
The main expenses were the toys, right? That's where the money started flowing in. I have a question about that, because you told me on the way here that you had a few boats, a few jets, a helicopter, and this deal came to you because of the status that you started to build and the word that started to spread that Michael's the guy to talk to about business. Are status symbols and the way you dress and what you watches you wear and what car you drive, like, the marketing of the mafia guys to attract people to show, look, I know how to make money. That's why I wear these things. That's why I am the way I am. Is that something on purpose?
I'll tell you what I figured out. I had 15 guys in my crew. And, one of the things that guys in the street, they want to become made guys. They want to take the oath. It's their badge of honor, right? Like I was a made guy. So I sat all 15 guys down, and I'll tell you what the end result was. And I said, listen, if any one of you here want to get made, this is not the place for you. I'm not going to propose any one of you. Not happening. Why not? Very simple. Because if I put a lot of time and effort into you and I propose you and you get made, I lose you. You're your own guy at that point. You don't have to answer to me anymore. So why would I put all this time and effort into you and then lose you? I said, so you're free to leave. No hard feelings. Still love you. Well, you're not going to get made. However, if you want to make money, this is the place to be, because I'm going to make every one of you wealthy. And that's what I did. So we were known as the wealthiest crew. So everybody wanted to be around us. They were like my marketing people out there, who had a boat, who had a car, who's driving this, who's driving that. So, hey, guys around Francis, they're all making money. So they would come to me. I found out, listen, money is a great commodity when you're giving it to other people. Mm. And especially on the street, money, people want to earn. It's money and power, mostly money. Mm-hmm. And they were my marketing people back then. So yeah, people would come to me, hey, look at his crew. These guys they're doing well. He's spreading the wealth.
So that status translated to other people coming to you with deals, coming to you to be recruited by you. And that grew the operation.
Tarek, and I'm not saying this out of any, there's no ego involved in this. I'm being really honest with you. It would be a deal a day. I would have a place on Mondays where I told people, if you wanted to come and see me and propose anything to me, we called it Mondays, Michael's and Mondays. It was really Mondays, but they called it Michael's because it was my place. But they would come Monday night and I would, and sometimes have a line of people just coming in, sitting down and proposing something to me.
Interesting. And could you explain the thing that you explained to me, that money buys peace, like when you spread it around your own? Because that's something that David and me noticed in our business. I was speaking to Michael and he said something very interesting. We noticed that we get the most peace if our close family members and our people around us earn with us. We see a lot of business owners, they start to make money, they buy the nice car, they get the nice office, but all the employees stay broke and all their family members stay broke. Was it the same thing in your life?
Absolutely. Breeds resentment. And the consequences of resentment on the street are a lot more severe. So you have to watch for that. I made everybody earn. I didn't care. I give you an example too. My Russian partners, they came to me because they were unable to collect a small debt. And one of the guys brought them around to me. They had about 6 gas stations called Gas Stop in Brooklyn. That was their brand. And they found out, they heard that I was in the business that I was in. So I sat down with them and I said, you guys are hustlers, it's great. I said, we can go into business together. Well, what's the relationship? I said, very simple, 75% me, 25% you. So the Russian looked, there was 3 of them, right? And Mike Markowitz looked at me and he said, Mr. Michael, that doesn't seem fair. I said, it's very fair. I said, why? I said, because you're on the street. You're going to steal from me a little bit. At least now I won't be that upset with you. I said, but don't let me catch you. But at least now I know I'm getting the lion's share of it, right? So I'll never forget, Tarek. 1 minute, Mr. Francisco, Mr. Michael. And they go to 3 of them huddle up together. And he comes back. He says, you have a deal. Because he got it too, you know. It's the street. You got to give guys some leeway. And I'll tell you how significant that was. They were my partners for almost 7 years. We made a lot of money together. They were the greatest partners. They took their little bit on the side. I looked the other way. I didn't care. When I went to prison, I told my father and I told the guys, my father was out. I said, listen, these guys are very loyal to me. We made a lot of money together. They're not pushovers. These are men. Treat them like men. Let them do their thing. They're going to bring you money every week. Every week without fail. They're honorable that way. Well, how do we know exactly? You don't have to know. They're going to bring you enough money every week. Don't let them enjoy themselves. Within 3 months after I went to prison, they destroyed the whole operation. 3 months. Not the Russians, my guys. They tried to put the arm on them. They tried to micromanage them and they wouldn't accept it. So what happened? I hate to say it, but we're on camera. That's the street life. You got to get it. They went after, they killed the goose that were laying the golden eggs. They shot one, killed him. They shot one of the other guys. He ended up in a wheelchair. Somehow he survived. And the third guy, David Bogatin, the best, he ran away. So they destroyed the whole operation in 3 months after I ran it for 7 years. So what does that tell you? Sometimes you let people enjoy, let them have their fun, let them make money, let them be happy. You know, I'm not saying in legitimate business that people should steal, but it's different on the street. You got to understand something. It's a little bit different. You know, people steal from you that they're not trustworthy. They got to go. But you got to let people enjoy themselves. You know, you got to let them earn. They got to feel like they're accomplishing something. Otherwise, if they're seeing you, it's natural. If they're seeing you living the high life and they're struggling, they're counting your money. There's one guy, I'll give you an example. Comes to me, he's on a really in bad shape. I said, I'm going to give you a job. What's a job? I want you to go around to every gas station and collect the money for me. That's it. How much are you going to pay? I'm going to pay you $3,000 a week because I really wanted to help his family. $3,000 a week back in the 80s. Do you know that after about 6 months, he comes to me and says, you think I can have a raise? I said, a raise? I said, do you think you're worth $3,000 a week? All you're doing is pick up money. I could get an autistic person to do that. But he was starting to count my money. Mm-hmm. So you have to, you know what I mean? There's a balance sometimes. Mm. I said, don't count my money. I gave you this opportunity. Now, you want it or you want to? Oh, okay. Then he backed off. And we became friends. I mean, I knew him a long time. It was family. But you're gonna run into all of that. So the idea is, you give them enough to make them happy and make them feel rewarded. And it worked for me.
Do you see the similarities?
Yeah. This is crazy. Yeah. But I have another question. Did you ever notice a change in character in the character of your members if they got wealthier?
when you say change in character.
Yeah. Or behavior.
Behavior? Yeah. Well, not really. I mean, not in a negative way, because I think I always made them understand that I can make this stop. Mm. I can do that. Don't give me a reason. Mm-hmm. I can cut this out for you. Just don't give me a reason. And I would tell them straight out, I want you to be happy. I want your family to be. I want you to make money. Enjoy yourself. Don't give me a reason to stop it. Mm-hmm. And that was taken well.
So you frequently, not frequently, but you sometimes reminded the people of the pecking order if they got out of line.
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, they got to know that my wife sometimes says this to me, you know, you become too friendly with people and then they take advantage. I didn't do that in my former life. I may do it a little bit now, you know, because it's different. But yes, you have to sometimes separate. Listen, we're friends, we're associate, but just remember I'm the boss and I can stop this at any time. Mm. Don't give me a reason. And they paid attention. So I never had to deal with anybody for doing that, for getting, you know, too carried away with themselves.
Interesting. So your father was a huge inspiration in what were the principles of being a man's man that he taught you? What were the key things that you always remembered?
Told me to keep my word. Very, very important. Your word means everything. He said, when you walk down the street, you got to hold your head up high. People got to respect you. Always respect women and children, treat them properly. You know, things like that. Be kind to little people. And again, he didn't mean that in a demeaning way. He just wanted me to be respectful to everyone. And I saw it because my dad was that way. And I saw how people related to him. You know, we used to go into clubs and my dad was always given deference, but I seen that he reciprocated. He didn't walk in there like what other guys walk in, like, you know who I am? You know, he didn't carry himself that way. They just knew it. But, and that was very attractive to me. And so I tried to carry myself the same way. My dad taught me a lot of good things. I don't think I would have navigated the life as well if he didn't put good things in front of me. And I listened. You know, I always tell people, be a good listener. You know, part of a negotiation, this sometimes, Tarek, you're going to be sitting down with people, you're going to be the smartest person in the room. By far. But why do you have to let people know that? Just keep quiet. Let them talk. Get everything you want to hear out of them. It's a big advantage. And there's times when you're not going to be the smartest people in the room. When you keep quiet, nobody knows that. Now let everybody talk. By the time they're finished talking, now I know a lot more than when I first came in. So I think it's a golden rule. You know, don't speak out of turn. You know, I've learned also, I mean, these are good things. Maybe, hopefully they don't apply in your life, but my father taught me to be the last person to judge somebody. Because in this life, your turn is going to come and people are going to remember. If you were the first one to point your finger at somebody, when your time comes, they're going to treat you the same way. And anytime I had to make a decision about somebody and that life could be very serious, I was the last one. Hey, I like to give them a shot. You know, let's see if we can work this out. And that's why, you know, that situation I described, they heard me out rather than let's just take this guy out, whatever. Because there was some damaging stuff in that article that was so untrue, but it was damaging for me. It could have been, they could have said, hey, let's just get rid of this now. But I wouldn't do that. And so they gave me deference. They let me talk. So, you know, things like that, that you don't think are real important. How often am I going to have to deal with this in my life? But maybe that one time could be very significant.
Did you have other role models next to your dad?
You know, Joe Colombo, I think, had the biggest impact on me in that life because he carried himself well. He was kind of my mentor when my dad went away. I knew him obviously well. He had sons that I was close with. Other than that, you know, I don't know how to explain this without sounding wrong, but I never held people in like, wow, you know, in high esteem. I have a lot of respect for people, you know. I have respect for Jordan Peterson. I sat down with him. I love the way he carries himself, the way he thinks before he talks. I have a lot of respect for him. Patrick Bet-David, I respect Patrick a lot, self-made guy. But I would never held anybody in awe other than my dad. And that was when I was younger. And I think one of the reasons for that too is because when my dad came home from prison, I expected him to like conquer the world. And I say that he wasn't the same guy, but I think he was the same guy. I just looked at him differently. Because younger growing up, you have this idealistic view. Wow, he's my hero. And then as I got older and started to, you know, understand life, well, he wasn't all that I thought he might be. You know what I mean? Because I expected he's going to come home. We're going to take over the world together. And he couldn't. And I put a lot of pressure mentally on what I expected from him. And when I didn't get it, it was disappointing. So I think that's what, and it wasn't his fault at all. It was just an impression. I think that taught me never to hold anybody in awe, no matter how much money they have. And I respect people for what they've accomplished, and I think you should, but we're all human.
David and me talk about it a lot, is we, you know, the higher we get in the echelons of life, the higher echelon we reach, is the less we kind of feel like money is the thing that we look at. And David's dad is a big, you know, inspiration also for me, as when I look at the way he carries himself, is, you know, he has a house, his wife is happy, his children are happy. Outside of his house, when I come there, I come every weekend, I'll visit my parents, my wife's parents, my in-laws, and his parents. And when I come to his house, there's a Rolls Royce, a Bentley, G-Class, Mercedes, whatever you can think of in that category in the garden. And he has his barbecue, but none of the cars is his. Like, he doesn't drive a car. He drives his work car, like a big truck, you know, and he doesn't care. The thing he cares about most is on Sunday being at the barbecue and having those people around him. And he always has this toast. He hardly speaks German. He's been in Germany for 25 years, but he hardly speaks German, you know, the way. But he always says, he has this toast. If I have to translate, he's like, what I want is, let's drink to that this table is the worst table that we're going to sit at, you know, in terms of like how much food is on the table. So he always toasts to the people and the gratitude. And that's all I kind of feel like is when you get the money, that's what you realize it's all about, you know, when you respect another man.
Absolutely. See, he's made it in life.
Yeah.
He's really made it in life. And I have so much respect for that. Like I said, you don't hold it in awe, but wow, he really gets it. Because that's what it's all about, you know? It's like I told you, Tarek, when I was making all this money, I wasn't sitting down counting every dollar. I was seeing the business succeed, and the money was a byproduct of that. And yeah, I was able to buy the toys and all of that, comfort, enjoyment. I was young. We had some fun. But it was succeeding that meant something. And in my mind, I'm saying, okay. See, here's the thing I had, and then my legs were cut out for me. I said, I'm never going to have to work for the rest of my life. I have my whole family taken care of. It's all great. No problem. I've done it. I've succeeded. And then, boom, I have my legs cut out, rightfully so, because I was doing the wrong thing in the street. And I learned the value of money is really, really comfort and peace of mind. You know, if somebody, you know, if my wine company tomorrow, somebody hands me a check for $500 million, am I going to go buy another building, 17 cars and all that? No. I'm going to say, okay, I can travel with my wife. Yeah, do you want to? I'm trying to talk her out of a Range Rover. She wants one. I don't like them, but I'm going to have to get it for her. You know, stuff like that. Yeah, you want it. You got it. No problem. Take care of my kids. Everybody's. And that's it. It isn't like I don't need anything else and I don't have a desire. Now, you're in a different stage of your life. But when you get to my stage, you're going to realize, hey, I've made it. I'm comfortable. I got peace. I took my family. They're all taken care of. I can enjoy myself. What's better than that? Really, what's better than that? Your father's got it right. Come here on Sunday. I got my whole family together. What more do I need? I'm the same way. I don't even own a car.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't need it now. I said to myself, what do I need a car for? When I'm home, I try not to go anywhere. I don't want to go within 5 miles of my house. I'm traveling all the time. So my wife says, would you buy another car? I said, for what? I said, okay, I'll buy one. I gave in. I said, I'm going to buy one now. Because my friend, my partner owns an Infiniti dealership. And these new, I have to tell you, the new Infiniti SUV. I forget what the model is.
It's QX or whatever.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. So I said, get me one. So he's going to get me one of them. But other than that, I probably won't put 10,000 miles a year on it. Maybe, because I don't go anywhere.
So, Michael, what would be your piece of advice for us? Maybe, you know, I'm not sure if you can understand our situation. We come from simple backgrounds. It's starting to make more money than we would ever possibly need. David is married, one kid, second on the way. I'm married, hopefully have kids soon. We stick by each other. Like, what are the shortfalls that we might face on this upward trend right now? Like,
listen, what I do say is this: do it while you're young. You're aggressive now. Do it while you're young. Make all the money that you possibly can at a young age. It gets harder as you get older, but don't do it by sacrificing your family life. Don't ever do that. You got to have the right balance and the right perspective on everything. And, you know, the toys are great. You know, like my wife will say to me, you know, look at the 8 years that we missed when I was in prison. We could have done all of those things back then. I said, yeah, but they would be over. We have now things to look forward to, you know, at an age when we can really enjoy it. Because when you're young, I mean, you enjoy yourself. I'm sure you're having a great time here. But right now, your head is largely into business and making more and making more, which is a good thing. You know, make all the money that you possibly can the right way. Prepare for your future. Very, very important, because when you get older, you're going to want to calm down and relax a little bit and enjoy the fruits of your work. But don't neglect your family along the way, and take care of people. You'll see it'll pay off in the end. Take care of people, make the people around you happy, and weed out those that, you know, don't fit into your circle properly. And don't be afraid to, you know, sometimes you got to, it's tough love. People are not working. You got to let them go sometimes. You know, you just have to. You know, you can't get sentimental about it. But that's my advice. You know, do it now. Do it when you're young. Enjoy it. But remember that you're old for a long time, God willing. And you want to prepare for that.
Just one personal question, because Tarek mentioned that I have a daughter. What do you think are the most important character traits, or maybe things to be a good father, especially for a daughter? I think you also have a daughter, right?
I have five.
Five?
Yes, five boys.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And two boys.
Yeah.
You know, be available. Give them the time. You know, part of success in life is showing up. Mm-hmm. I've always said that. Just show up. It can't be more important and in your house than to show up, be available. No matter what I'm doing, I'm in the middle of, my phone rings, my kids, I stop, pick up the phone. What's up? What's wrong? Be available to your children, very, very important. And just give them, you know, the right advice. Some of them, look, I gave my son good advice, he didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. My son was the most frustrating thing in my life. My son, Michael Jr.
That's a tough thing to say.
I'm telling you, the kid, and I communicate for a living. He would just turn me off. Didn't pay attention to anything I told him. It would drive me out of my mind. My wife and I, if we were ever going to get a divorce, it would have been over my son. Because she was, he's a late bloomer, she used to say. Pray for him. I said, but how late? He's in his 20s. You know, it drove me crazy because he didn't have, I guess I wanted him in many ways to be like me, be aggressive, be this, that, you know, brilliant athlete. This kid could have been playing for the New York Yankees. I said to him, if your head and your heart ever matched your ability, you'd be making a ton of money. You'd be playing for the pros right now. You just didn't want it, you know, and you can't, sometimes you just can't force things on them. Mm. Now he's doing great. Yeah, he's straightened out, just had his first baby. He said, Dad, and now it comes to me all the time, Dad, I'm having a baby, what should I do? I said, you want my advice? Yeah, put your big boy pants on now. I said, things change dramatically right now, am I right? You're going to have a child that's going to depend upon you, and you want him to rely on you and look up to you, and really you're going to be his hero. And he's acting just that way. It's amazing. I never thought he would act this way as a father. Unbelievable. The kid's only 9 months old, my grandson, but he's a doting dad. He's like the best thing that ever happened to him in his life. You know the feeling. So, you know, be available for your kids, instill all the right values in them. And if they don't pay attention, I think if you give them that foundation, that they'll come back. That's my experience with my son. You know, my other son, he just wanted to be in a mob. Dad, I know you got money buried. Just tell me where it is. I'll go get it. And we all have to relax. I said, stop. You know, he's the other. I had my girls have been relatively easy. My two sons have been driving me crazy, but they're okay now. They're all right. But like I said, be available, instill the right values in them at an early age. Give them their space, because some of them, you got seven kids, they're all different. You know, I have to give my wife more credit, because my daughters acted pretty much like her. They're all okay. My sons, I don't know. They had that gene in them, I guess. But it's the best advice I can give you. Be available.
Is that the same advice you recently met Andrew and Tristan Tate? Is that similar advice that you gave them? Or what did you guys mainly talk about?
We talked about a lot of things. I told, and you know, I really enjoyed both Andrew and Tristan. You would be surprised if I tell you this, but the more sensitive one, Andrew. Andrew was more sensitive. You wouldn't think that from his outward appearance. He's very smart, very, very bold. I mean, I have respect for who he is as a guy and what he's accomplished and how he came up from nothing, him and his brother. What I love for them, I love the bond between the two of them. You know, I used to think that there was an expression in Italians growing up, maybe you had the same, blood is thicker than water. I found that not to be true. I've seen families go against each other, a lot of headache. But those two are like, they just have each other's back. And I love to see the relationship between the two of them. But, you know, I told Andrew, I said, Andrew, you know, got to try to tone it down a little bit. They got all of these cases, and I would try to just tone it down a little bit. You know, don't be your own worst enemy. And he listened. You know, we had good discussion. I thought my interview with him was great. You know, my style in interviewing is I let the person talk. You know, it's my show, so people hear me. I want the person, the guest, to talk, you know, and I'll interject when it's appropriate. So he said a lot of good things. The discussion was great. Tristan, the same thing, spoke more about his case. And my advice to them, I said, because of my experience, I said, you have to fight the littlest matter like your life depends upon it, because you don't understand these people. They're underhanded. They're treacherous. They have all the laws in their favor. They got all the tools, all the weapons. You take nothing for granted and fight the littlest thing like it's the biggest thing in your life, because that's what it takes to beat them. I beat them 5 times. I know. I worked my butt off. Why did I do that? Because I watched my father get railroaded. Depended upon his lawyer. Whatever his lawyer said he did, boom. He ends up destroying his life. I didn't do that. I was right on top of my lawyer, right on top of my investigators. If I didn't like his decision, I let him know, and I interfered in it. Or injected, I should say. You can't sit back and let other people's put your life in other people's hands. And that's the best advice that I gave them.
That's the experience that I also made with our lawyers. You know, we never got into such trouble, but you know, driving without a driver's license was one of them. And sometimes, you know, if you don't think, if you're not involved mentally in what they're trying to achieve, sometimes they're trying to just dump stuff just to, I don't know, charge you more or just get it over with or whatever.
Absolutely.
We had this case driving without a driver's license, and we had a chance of getting it knocked off. But if I showed up there, there would have been 100% chance of me getting destroyed, because we have come up from a town of 20,000 people. So every police officer knows us because we drive these cars, and the judge will hate me. And he's like, no, we should show up. And I found out he wanted me to show up because it's a 1,500 euro extra charge. I'm like, dude, just so I understand, if I show up, we can and they convict me, let's say, I cannot take it back, right? I cannot take the case back and say I'll stick with the old conviction. He's like, no. I'm like, why the hell would I go then?
Of course.
And he's like, well, and I knew it was okay. He was the money. So I, you know, it's true. I mean, it's a different scale.
No, but listen, little thing, big things, all the same. You don't. You don't trust your lawyer 100%. If you're putting your life in his hands or your fate in his hands, you want to know exactly what he's doing. You know, I had a small instance when Rudy Giuliani indicted me on a big case, huge racketeering case. I was a lead defendant. I had 15 co-defendants. I'm getting off my plane in the airport, and feds are there. They locked me up. They're driving me in the car. I'm in the back of the car. I said, where are we going? They said, we're going to Manhattan. I said, why are we going to Manhattan? My case was in Brooklyn, different district, the gas. I thought it was about that. They said, no, we're going to Manhattan. I said, why? Well, Giuliani is charging you. Giuliani, charging me with what? I had no idea, Tarek, no idea whatsoever. I get there, I find out they're charging me. It was a big leasing company that had 1,500 legitimate leases on the street, and they had 30 Shylock loans where they lent money to people at a usurious rate. And they claimed that I put up all the money. I didn't put up one penny. I wasn't even involved. Long story short, but I told my lawyer, I said, listen, I want to go in and tell them they made a mistake. Oh, you can't do that. You know, I said, no, you can come with me, but I want to go in and tell them in advance. I'm thinking it's going to cost me a couple of $1,000,000 to defend myself all this time on trial, everything else. So he said, no, you can't go. I said, I'm going with or without you. I go, I sit down. He said, hey, everything's being recorded. I said, fire away. Had a whole session, right? Boom, they indict me anyway. Okay. But what happens? I go to trial. They put the FBI agent on the stand that was in the room when I went in there first, right? What did Franzese do? Well, he came in originally. And what did he say? He said he had nothing to do with this. They went through my whole thing, right? I get acquitted. You know what the jury says? Why would you have gone in there if you were innocent and told them everything that you told them on tape? So I told my lawyer, I said, see, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I said, if I were to listen to you, I said, that strong part of the case would never have been shown. Just an example. So they don't always do the right thing. They're motivated by money sometimes. They wanted to go to trial. I paid them a whole bunch of money for trial. So you got to be careful. Even though they're in your corner and they're defending you, they have their own ulterior motives also. You gotta fight your cases no matter what they are.
Interesting. I got one last question if you have anything else.
No.
You want to go first?
No, you can.
You know, when we talked in Newport, we have a very hot temper, me and David. Mm-hmm. And I said to David, thank God I'm not in your shoes. I will never be in your shoes in terms of having this much power, this much capability to just do this and have people disappear, you know. How did you manage having all that power and not resorting to violence all the time, even though you knew you could? Because I catch myself all the time. I mean, I'm in legitimate business, but if someone pisses me off, I'm like, dude, let's just get some baseball bats and just, you know, but and then I calm down, I have my cigar, and then we're all good. But if I were in your shoes, I mean, I don't know. I think I would have been a lunatic. How did you manage all that power?
Because I watched everybody I knew in that life, everybody without exception, that abused their authority or abused their power. They never lasted. Never lasted. You know, there's guys that were, that would be their first course of action. And what happened? People said, what do we need to deal with this guy anymore? He's a loose cannon. Let's just get rid of him. I've never seen anybody that acted that way last in that life. None of them. So listen, I have a pretty good temper myself, but I've really learned how to control it. Because again, on the street, you cannot show your cards. You really can't. You have to play things very close to the vest. It's very important. You can't let people know what you're thinking. If you're unhappy with something or someone, you got to be careful how you communicate it, if you communicate it. And so I was just always very mindful of that. You know, because look, you know what I realized too, and I'm not saying anybody, in life, it's not strong people you have to worry about. It's weak people that are given power that they really didn't earn. Strong people, they know who they are. They're strong, you know that, you see them right away. No problem. Weak people that are given power that they never really earned, dangerous. They'll abuse it, they'll become bullies. It's happening in our government, it's happening, I've seen it happen so often. You can't hand people, weak people, power.
Yeah, we see it in schools. We talk about it all the time. You, me and David joke about it because we used to be the bully in school. And sometimes there was this kid that was getting bullied and we felt sorry for them. So we took him in and we're like, mm-hmm. No, this guy's with us now. And then this piece of shit, you know, because you were protecting him, he got cocky and now he started to, you know, try to get at you in front of the people. And then you're like, okay.
Because he's weak.
You know? And then those are usually the people that got bullied in school that never were able to, you know, project authority, that then later on, if they become a teacher or a police officer, they're the absolute worst.
They're the worst. Absolutely worst. You know, and you always gotta, and you can pick them out pretty well. I can. I'm really observant of that. And it bothers me to no end, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, no, I don't have anything else, so.
Well, yeah. Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Yes, you guys have been great. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much for this crazy insights.
And for everyone listening, Michael said something that, you know, made me very happy before we started the podcast. He said it's a start of a long partnership. We hope so. So we're looking forward to doing this more frequently, hopefully at one of our other events. If you like this podcast, please leave a comment. This is the only way that you guys can show us that you like what we do. If you hate what we do, leave us a comment as well, and we'll try to fix it. So it's just us trying to do great content for you. Thank you very much for listening, and have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.